morning, everybody, and welcome to this event. My name is Mary Martin. I'm Director of UN Business and Human Security Initiative at NSC Ideas. This is the second in a series of discussion events which Ideas has organised with student societies linked to the Diplomacy Ball that many of you went to last week. There are three events in collaboration with the UN, the Amnesty International, and the Grimshaw LSE Student Union Societies, which aim to talk about things under a general theme of navigating international affairs in an age of uncertainty. So tonight I'm delighted to be looking at uncertainty, and this makes me think of Donald Rumsfeld saying you've got known unknowns and unknown, or known unknowns, unknown unknowns, through a particular lens. But tonight what we're looking at, uncertainty or known unknowns or unknown unknowns, through the lens of gender. Which I'm glad to say, although I don't work on it directly, I have a lot to do with it in the work that we do at NSC Ideas with the UN and with business and security and development. And I think it's become a particularly rich stream of research and policy in international politics. And what a generation of international relations scholars have done in the last two decades, really, show that studying gender is not only interesting and worthwhile in its own right, but how it's giving us indispensable insights into how to achieve peace, security, and development through critiquing traditional approaches and laying bare some of the limitations. And I think this has led to some, although perhaps one of my speakers will disagree with this, but I think it has led to some innovations in policy and practice, although I'm sure they're going to tell you there's more still to be done. So let me introduce the panel. Two people who have a lot of experience and insight to offer tonight. On my right is Amira Sawas, who is Senior Research, on my left, orientation all wrong, is a Senior Research and Policy Specialist at ActionAid UK, where she's building capacity on feminist approaches to research. She's led research on the intersections of gender, environment, infrastructure and security. She's worked extensively in Pakistan with people affected by violence and insecurity, and has recently conducted research in Jordan and Kenya. Say she's an NSC alum as well. Next to her, Bella Kapoor is very intern, because she's visiting senior fellow at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security here in LSC. She's an advisor on inclusion in peace processes. I think we're going to hear a lot about that this evening. She served as the interim women's empowerment advisor in the UN support mission in Libya, and the political affairs advisor to the UN Special Envoy for Syria in Damascus. Her most recent major position with the UN was as head of the Secretariat of the Secretary General's high-level independent panel on peace operations in 2015. And she now works supporting local and international civil society women activists in their efforts to organize for change. So thank you both for coming tonight and helping to kick off what I hope will be a good discussion amongst us all. Maybe I will start with Amira. Just from your experience, tell us how you see the agenda of women, peace and security in 2019.
Very big question. So I thought I'd start off by saying what actually is women, peace and security, because several years ago I had a bit of a misconception that it was only about ensuring women were involved in peace processes and negotiations. But over time, the work that I was doing, which was on gender and its intersections with security and environment, eventually people started saying to me, oh, you're a WPS person. And I was like, what is this? So I started looking into it and realized that it's so much broader than that. So I'm going to read out the goals of WPS because I think it will help to root what I'm about to say about the work I've been doing. So there have been 8 resolutions adopted by the UN Security Council on the WPS agenda. And of course, there have been shifts in prioritization of the agenda, but more recently it seems, although maybe Bella would have better insights on this, it seems as though there has been a kind of reinvigoration or the idea that it's very important and it needs to be operationalized rather than something kind of symbolic. So there's 4 broad goals. One is prevention. So prevention of conflict and all forms of violence against women and girls in conflict and post-conflict situations. There's participation. Women participate equally with men, and gender equality is promoted in peace and security decision-making processes at national, local, regional, and international levels. Protection. So women and girls' rights are protected and promoted in conflict-affected situations. And relief and recovery. So women and girls' specific relief needs are met, and women's capacities to act as agents in relief and recovery are reinforced in conflict and post-conflict situations. So as you can see, it's a very, very broad, which is important, it's a broad agenda. So there are many people working on WPS who don't even realize they're working on it. And I just wanted to also highlight that, you know, the WPS agenda has been a civil society driven process. There's a good website, which is of the NGO working group on WPS, and there's so much information. So if you just Google that, it's a very useful kind of website. So there's been a lot of work going on WPS, especially from women's rights organisations and peacebuilding NGOs. But time and time again, a kind of critique comes up about what is actually happening on the ground. So, for example, at a UN Security Council meeting in November 2018, Rasha Jahan, who's a Yemeni woman peacebuilder, stated, although women continue to play a leading role in peacebuilding, and the Council's presidential statement explicitly calls for their meaningful inclusion, women are still largely excluded from the peace negotiation process. We attribute this to a patriarchal philosophy of peace mediation, which rewards violence by granting space at the negotiation table only to holders of weapons rather than to real peacemakers. Now, I don't necessarily personally agree that you shouldn't have the people who have the weapons at this space, but I think her point is really important, and it's something that I've noticed myself as a very, like, over time I've become much more aware of feminism and institutional patriarchy, and so working in the security sector, more recently I've been in the security sector and kind of ended up there, you know, there are certain kind of manifestations of patriarchy which become really obvious if you have a feminist mindset. So mannels are everywhere. So a lot of the discussion around security and conflict especially is you tend to see a lot of privileged northern men, and without lived experience necessarily of what they're talking about. And as a result of that, because of that kind of homogenous nature of the discussions, a lot of assumptions seem to be made about women, about what women want, about what women can do, especially women from the global south. So what I've heard quite a lot is, they're not interested in this peace building process or this kind of natural resource management process, or they don't have the capacity. Or how is gender relevant? Which has been asked sometimes by quite senior policymakers, and just think, oh my gosh, there's a lot of work to do here. Or gender's just too difficult. Because one of the critiques of Women, Peace and Security agenda is that some of their activities under that title just focus on getting numbers of women in the room. But is having the numbers of women there, okay, that, of course that's a good step forward, but is that meaningful participation? And there are questions around that. Another issue is that funding is really hard to come by, particularly for grassroots organisations. So another women peacebuilder, Angelina Jial, I think is how you pronounce her name, on March the 8th, she was briefing the UN Security Council on South Sudan, and she said, there's intense competition between international and national NGOs for humanitarian resources. The bulk of funding goes to UN agencies and INGOs. The smallest portion goes to national NGOs. And within national civil society, by far the smallest portion of that funding goes to women-led organisations. So we need to start interrogating how patriarchal power is everywhere and how it filters down and impacts what people can actually do, especially women, in terms of the Women, Peace and Security agenda. Now, that's not to say really good stuff hasn't been done, and it has, and, you know, you see it, but we have to also start looking at ourselves, and that's something that I was bringing up regularly in the security sector, which did not always go down well, because it meant that people who have power in that sector were being challenged about their positionality. And even I question my own positionality all the time. Am I the right person to be talking about women in Pakistan, where I've done a lot of work, for example? So another agenda which is worth mentioning, which kind of overlaps with WPS, is called the Sustaining Peace Agenda. So this is, after the SDGs, there was a kind of question about, is the UN system set up to be able to address the interlinking challenges of humanitarian issues and development issues? And of course not, because the UN system is very siloed. So even though you have a lot of great people working in the UN system, because of the nature of the siloing, they couldn't necessarily work together. So over the last couple of years, this agenda has been pushed more and more. And, you know, fundamentally, the aim is to change the UN system to address root causes of conflict, underdevelopment and inequality. So looking at conflict and development in a cycle and how they impact each other. And so I think my work has kind of accidentally got there. I started off doing my PhD on water and sanitation programming from a gender perspective in Pakistan. And then, of course, there were lots of security impacts, human security, but also communal and even national security issues around water. And so that's kind of how I ended up there. So there's three areas of research and policy and programming that I've been working on, which relate to WPS. So that's gender, environment, and security. It's probably the easiest way to put it. And particularly in Pakistan. So the kinds of questions that I've been asking are, what are the relationships between gender and urban violence in Pakistan? What about climate change and gender-based violence? What about justice mechanisms from a gender perspective in post-conflict or fragile places? So out of the four pillars that I talked about at the beginning, I've mostly worked on the prevention, protection and relief, protection and relief and recovery aspects, much less the kind of participation in peace processes. But my colleague will be talking about that, which is great. One thing I was involved in last year, which was very interesting, was there was a Swedish-led UN Security Council debate about the Lake Chad Basin conflict, which has become very fashionable kind of topic for policy, a regional conflict for policymakers, not to detract from the huge importance of focusing on it, but suddenly everybody I was working with were very interested in it. And so this was the first time really we managed to get gender on the agenda there. And they brought in a Chadian woman civil society activist to talk about the gender aspects of that conflict. And she made a very, very critical statement, which sticks in my mind, although I wish I had the quote in front of me, about why men in the region, because we're talking about gender, of course, not necessarily, I mean, women is very important and her perspective, but she was talking about why the men were getting involved in the conflict. And she was talking about masculinity and gender norms and saying that, you know, men from where I'm from would rather, you know, go into the sea than, like, see their family starve because of the livelihood issues that were happening in the region. So kind of leading on from that into the work that I've been doing, one of the kind of prevention areas that I've been trying to understand or the root causes is about gendered violence and exclusions. And one area is the impact of global security issues on gendered violence. So particularly in Pakistan, I've looked at the linkages between everyday violence and the global war on terror in the context of urban Pakistan by basically doing ethnographic and participatory research, you know, very participatory, basically led by local people from the communities that we were studying, to understand what is the biggest form of violence, what are the different forms, who's affected by what kind of violence, and then understanding where that, you know, what narratives and discourses impact that. And it's important to point out here, if we're talking about women, peace and security, that the biggest burden of violence in the world is not conflicts. Although conflicts massively impact the world in many, many ways, the biggest burden of violence is everyday violence. And that's domestic violence, that's communal violence, you know, that's structural violence, if you studied that. So we need to start drawing attention to the importance of that in the women, peace and security agenda as well. So Pakistan's quite an interesting place because it is kind of, or was, still is a bit the epicenter, really, of the global war on terror, even though Afghanistan, you know, was invaded, or however we would frame it, there was a conflict in Afghanistan in 2001 for different reasons. Pakistan, being a neighbour of Afghanistan and a US ally, became absolutely critical to the response. And on top of that, there was huge displacement into Pakistan. So until the war in Syria, or the crisis in Syria, Pakistan had the highest number of international refugees in the entire world for a long time. So they are, you know, there are lots of issues about being the neighbour, but also the ally of the invading, or the country or coalition that comes in. So this has had an impact in many, many ways on everyday violence. You know, that you hear about Pakistan, you think about terrorism, being very honest, that comes to mind, particularly around the time that we were doing the research, which was between 2013 to 2016, there was particularly high levels of urban violence, so terrorist incidents, political violence. So what we learned over time, which I don't have enough time to go into too much detail, was that basically the security, the way that the state dealt with these kind of impacts, say terrorism or political violence, was very brutal and it was very masculinist, the way that they thought about it and responded. So there were a lot of enforced disappearances of young men. There was rounding up of huge groups of young men. That it became much less safe for women to go outside in this period of time. And so as a result of that, there were knock-on impacts to domestic violence at the household level and to communal violence. I don't have much time to go into detail, but I'll be happy to talk about it in other settings. But my concern, or our concern really, was that, you know, the blowback of the global war on terror is not just limited to suicide bombings and drone attacks, but also long-term reconfiguration of kind of urban spaces and how they operate and who gets targeted by state violence and who fights with each other and so on and so forth. One of the kind of good examples of this is the community, the ethnic group who, they live in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but were largely displaced into Pakistan and from the northern areas where the drone attacks were, the Pashto population or Pashtun, depending on who says it, are also very much targeted by the state now. So they're kind of branded as terrorists, largely by the state and elite society. And as a result, it's very difficult for them to get legitimate work. It's very difficult for them to be kind of perceived as equals, and as a result you have kind of crime and security impacts due to that state violence and inequality. So one of the things my colleagues and I have been talking about is, and this has been written about way before us, so it's not our idea at all, but using feminist insights on violence and security. So putting a feminist lens on thinking about femininities and masculinities, thinking about how the state thinks about gender, because if you look at it, this is not just Pakistan, this is every state. Most states have a very gendered narrative around their constitution. And if you look at who makes decisions, it's usually men from elite backgrounds. And this impacts how everything, how policy is thought about, and the impacts throughout society. So another area kind of knocking on from that, I would say, that I've been working on also in Pakistan is gendered securitization logics. So water has become a good example, because I've been working on environmental stuff on water. So this securitization logics work, all this work has been in partnership with colleagues in Pakistan, emerged through the research, basically. So water has been tied in with state building. So if you look at the very inception of the country, which was through partition with India, there's a very big kind of river basin that runs all the way through Pakistan and also India. So a lot of the kind of, even the decision on how to divide up the countries, even the international conflict and narratives around that, was very much tied into water and how water is like the food or the life of the country. You know, 80% of water is used for agriculture in the country, which causes lots of, you know, basically lack of water for your everyday citizen, but because agriculture is seen as like the driving force of national security and economic growth. So even before the war on terror, coming back to the patriarchal security state, we call it, there has been a long history of political economic violence. The state was formed through violence, and it wasn't that long ago, 1947. And as I was saying, water's tied into that at multiple levels. So in Karachi, which is a mega city that was really affected by a lot of violence, there was a narrative about water mafias, you know, violent water mafias controlling access to water and the state needing to intervene in quite strong ways. So we were working there at the time. So we started interrogating the way that the state was responding. And they, for example, sent in the Rangers, which is the paramilitary, in order to kind of securitize the water. And it was framed very much as a national security threat. So it was quite a brutal response, which has had knock-on effects over periods of time. So we started thinking about where are these logics coming from? Like, there are millions of people in this country who only get 1 hour of water a day, if any, through the pipes. And, you know, there are many people who don't have access to any potable water, and that's making them really sick. And many children and people are dying as a result of this. So why aren't they thinking about human security? Where is this logic coming from? And so basically we realized that there were like four different logics, and the most strong by far was this terrorism logic. Like, we need to securitize the water. We need to send in the troops to do that. And, you know, like stopping the illegal activity and securing our country and our city. So again, coming back to the risk imagination, the security imagination, thinking about it is very gendered. And there's been a lot of challenges from women's rights activists around this. So they're asking questions around who's thinking about this, who's deciding that this is a security risk. Why aren't they thinking about the fact that, you know, women can't leave their houses in certain neighborhoods because of gendered ideas around mobility? So if they run out of water, they will sit in the home all day, because they're too scared to go outside because they might have sexual harassment, or they might be questioned, their reputation might be questioned for going outside. If they don't manage the water in the home, sometimes we found that this would bubble over into domestic violence. So what women's rights activists have been doing, and it's a really good time to talk about this actually, because there was a big march on Friday, International Women's Day, called the Aurette March, which was led by civil society activists, women, mostly, you know, many, many working class women, of course, elite women were involved as well, but they developed a manifesto, like, what we want to see is change in our country. And one of the things was to stop enforced disappearances, which has been a big issue, peaceful protest, you know, non-violent resolution of conflict, as well as many other issues like gender-based violence, for example. But what's really interesting is when you take a feminist approach like that in a very patriarchal state, you do get a backlash. So there's been a really challenging backlash where the women who were involved in it, the women who were holding placards, you know, people have actually gone and, like, doctored the placards and put something, like, really obscene on it and shared it around and said, what is this? You know, women, it's totally obscene. Why do, you know, they shouldn't be marching? And there's a huge backlash. It's in the media all the constantly. And the individual activists who set up this march are being targeted, you know. So this is the challenge when you're trying to do this kind of work. I just have a couple of minutes left. Yeah, so the other area of work that I've been looking at is the nexus between gender, climate change, and security. So there's been a huge amount of interest in the climate change and security relationship over the last 10 years. There's been quite a lot of discussion in the UN Security Council, for example. And actually right now, just over the last couple of months, as a result of a lot of advocacy on this, the UN has kind of set up what's called a mini mechanism to deal with climate change and security. So they've got, basically, they're trying to join up United Nations Development Programme, United Nations Environment, the UN Peacebuilding Support Office, and I believe the UN Political Affairs Unit. I think they've merged. And so they're basically trying to create ways for them to work together to be able to understand the risks of climate change and security crises. So some examples that have come up in terms of regional crises are the Lake Chad Basin conflict, the Syria crisis, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Mali. So they're very much trying to see these risks in advance rather than waiting for them to happen. Because the argument is, if they're related to climate change, we can try and prevent climate change from getting worse and making the situation worse. But what there hasn't been is a gender perspective. Because as I was saying, these security spaces are so patriarchal, to be honest, that, yeah, it's been, the gender perspective has kind of been pushed and pushed and pushed. And the amount of times that I was told, what is gender to do with this, was very frustrating. But practitioners and civil society activists have been more and more interested. And, you know, actually we see in our work that gender is really important to understanding this nexus. So, again, these kind of a result of it being very patriarchal. There are these masculinist tropes, you know, that women are victims of climate change and women, you know, women are virtuous to the environment. And of course, there are probably lots of women that are virtuous with the environment. And there are also lots of women who are victims of climate change, but there are also women who are doing really great work for climate change, and there are also women who are polluting and don't care about sustainability. So it's really about, like, challenging these, like, simplistic narratives. And there's been some feminist researchers who've done some really great work. One of them, she's called Chitra Nagarajan. She is based in northern Nigeria, so she's looking at the Lake Chad Basin conflict from a gender perspective. And basically, bringing in intersectional insights. So looking at who is most likely to fight, you know, which men are most likely to fight, which women get involved in the conflict, which women are peace builders, you know, what's the impact of the conflict on women with disabilities, and really trying to ground it. And so she was also actually invited to brief the Security Council last year because they recognised that actually, you know, somebody is focusing on this nexus from a very grounded perspective. And we also saw in the work on Pakistan very clearly that, you know, when there are already precarious livelihoods which are impacted by climate change as well as other things, in environments where women's mobilities are restricted and where the pressure is really high for men to live up to masculinities around breadwinning, it can bubble over into domestic violence and communal violence. That doesn't mean that the place is bad, it just means there are multiple pressures and gender norms are very critical to it. So understanding that is critical to doing any kind of response work, but this is where the gap is often. So what this kind of means is that WPS is also relevant to the resilience agenda as well as many other agendas, but there's still kind of work to be done to pull that together. So I was working last year with the United Nations Environment to try and build awareness of this, as well as build awareness of, you know, how do you do intersectional programming around this. They have a big program with UNDP called Women, Natural Resources and Peace Building, but they recognize that just saying women is not enough to, you know, to understand the relationships between women and men, to make sure that the women that participate are not the most powerful women, you know, that it's a broader perspective. So I think there's a lot of interesting work going on, but it just takes time. And now at ActionAid, I haven't been there long, I've been there for 5 months, but I can just very briefly talk about some of the relevant work. One area that ActionAid is focusing on is women's leadership in crises. So they're trying to create opportunities to promote feminist leadership and to use case studies and show, you know, vulnerable and marginalised women, introduce them to other vulnerable and marginalised women who've taken on leadership positions in crises, to kind of role model and give confidence that they, you know, they do have the skills and the relevant expertise, and they just need that money to support them, like everyone else gets the money. So it's nurturing feminist leadership over long periods of time. And the other area that I'm working quite intensively at the moment is on gender justice. So ActionAid is focusing on access to justice for women and other marginalized groups, basically. So that's over the next few years, and we're doing research in Jordan, Ghana, Tanzania, and Nepal. But at the moment, I've been doing quite a lot of research in Jordan. So how is the law from a gender perspective? How can women use the law for protection? And there's a lot of very interesting stuff where women are changing the law. So there are coalitions of lawyers, for example, who are, you know, challenging articles in the law, and kind of, for example, there was one article 308, which was abolished last year, which was that if a woman survivor, she was raped, if she reported it, she might be forced to marry the rapist. So this is a very old law which just didn't fit in with society. And although it is culturally practiced at times, you know, it was abolished because the women's rights activists really pushed it. So looking at security, women, peace and security from a broader perspective around justice is something that we're really interested in. ActionAid. I'm going to stop there. I've talked much longer than I should have, I apologise.
Thank you very much. I think that was a great sort of introduction and a wonderful overview of the kind of diversity and depth of the WPS agenda, which, as you've heard, is obviously very dynamic at the moment as well. And I particularly like your focus on that kind of intersection of different, what were silos of activities here around environment and women, but also the other thing which I suppose I hadn't reflected, although from enough I've done work on it, your term about blowback from, you know, existing policies that were just of them, and certainly to be thought of by policymakers, how this affects women and how women can affect them. And the war on terror is, in lots of instances, one of the culprits of that. I did some work recently in Mexico on the northern border, which has become notorious now for other reasons, thanks to Mr. Trump. But in the towns along that border, what you've had since 1994 in the NAFTA agreement, which again is what Trump wants to demolish, you've had a huge explosion of industries, and it's sucked a load of workers in, and a lot of them were women, young women. Because, and when I asked, you know, why they employed women, no, probably it was because they were cheaper, but I was told, no, because they have very small hands and they can do the fine work needed to make car components and so on. But what happened as a result of that, which made obviously a lot of people rich, including, to be fair, Mexicans, you know, gave them employment and so on. But what you had was a whole load of what were called femicides and real dreadful massacres, because these women were exposed to both domestic violence, because they were doing jobs that were not traditional, and also they were used as alibi scapegoats for all kinds of other things that were going on in this huge social upheaval. So the idea of blowback from a policy that in theory has nothing to do with women, but actually has an awful lot to do with women and women have to do with that, I think is a very good example of how the, you know, even if you're not studying or working in the area of WPS directly, why it enriches our understanding of social processes generally. So thank you. And I'm sure we'll come back to some of those things in the discussion. So if I can turn to Bella, who's got a similar but also different experiences from your experiences. I suppose my question to you, but I'm sure you're going to tell us much more, is how can we mobilise more meaningful engagements by women, not just in everyday peace building, but also in formal peace processes, which I think you've worked on. But let me give you the floor.
65,000
questions. We may not get to the full answer, yeah. But start us off, please.
Make some sense. Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming. And thanks, Samira. I'm going to piggyback on some of your points. Just to spend a few moments on me, so you can maybe follow where I'm coming from on this. I did my work in human rights and conflict. That was my entry point. And after that, I started looking at the political side of conflict, so related to grievances, but also challenges in resolving conflict. And then it's only been the past few years that I've actually started thinking seriously about exclusion, and specifically now working with women, also with older people, and specifically with young people. So I just put that out there because it might make sense or not when I kind of give you my little spiel of how I interpret things and how I try to make sense of it. So I wasn't brought up in a intellectual tradition of gender or feminism or women's rights. It wasn't particularly from that. It was really very much coming through it from a rights, but not a particularly women's rights. So I'd say human rights more broadly, conflict, politics, and now to exclusion. And when our colleagues asked us to come and speak, the title was, it wasn't as broad as WPS, it was something to do with, in this time of international uncertainty, what is the role of women in peace and security? And so when I was thinking about tonight, I was trying to go through, you know, what is this international uncertainty? What are we talking about? You know, so I kind of wanted to understand where women's participation fits in with international uncertainty. And I went through, and it was kind of quite scary how broad uncertainty can be beyond, you know, our little or not so little concerns here on this island with Brexit and with what Trump's up to, and globally these challenges that we are experiencing, or trends of nationalism or populism, and beyond the kind of inequalities, increasing inequalities within states, across states. We have those to think about. We then have what Many researchers are working on these global catastrophic risks in terms of super artificial intelligence, misuse of weapons or intentional use of weapons. And then what I was reading about some time ago is something that scientists refer to as this, and it's their words, this boring apocalypses, which is talking about what happens with a number of challenges kind of cascade together, and it's the relationship between all of them. So you could fit into that climate change, you could fit into that environmental risks, migration. So, you know, there's quite a lot of stuff out there at the big level. And in my little world of international peace and security, I see, and I'm sure you guys do as well, the challenges that we are facing within that. We talk about the internationalization of conflict, so where conflict may be physically within one area, but you have a lot of states meddling or involving themselves, so we refer to that internationalizing the conflict, the multiplicity of actors on the ground war fighting. Before it used to be regular state actors, but now you have private security contractors, you have mercenaries, you have so many different additional actors on the ground. We also have, as you know, in particular, is kind of related to the rise in violent extremism, we have the asymmetric means of warfare, how warfare is being used in terms of including drones. We have another aspect that makes it particularly complex, which is the transnational nature. So on the one hand, I'm going to kind of slightly contradict myself, but conflict isn't just taking place within one territory. It has regional repercussions. They may be fighting over the border. We saw that Darfur and Chad in the 2000s. But the actual way that conflict is working transnationally, the flow of weapons, of money, of communications, of ideas, of people, this also makes great challenges. And obviously something that we see a lot today is the impact on civilians. That we are seeing that, you know, more people are dying because of being civilians than are being killed on the battlefield. That certainly has increased. And against all of that, we have an international system, a multilateral system, that is under huge stress in terms of being able to prevent, being able to manage, and ideally being able to end conflict. And we can see that in the fact that, you know, the Syria conflict has been going on for 8 years, very hard to get Security Council agreement in terms of calling that to an end. The conflict in Ukraine has gone on since 2013-2014, how to get that to be resolved peacefully. We have Yemen ongoing, Libya, so very, very difficult to actually get international agreement in this multipolar world that we're living in. So then I think, oh, okay, we've got all of those problems, and what do women have to do with that? And how does that fit in? Like, why are the two being linked? And then I was thinking that actually there are many, many things that women are doing, which we'll talk about, which I kind of wanted to convey to you, that given, you know, this difficult challenge that you guys have said, that, you know, we need to look at the international uncertainty, where do women fit in? What I want to talk about is a little bit is about patriarchy and conflict, and then to talk about, well, actually, women are doing a lot, as are men, but women are doing a lot to try to break those connections between patriarchy and conflict. So, please do not just that. So I know a number of you are specialists in gender, and so you will have your various interpretations of patriarchy. Mine kind of is maybe a little bit different from what I think a lot of people think about. And I want to actually quote, because Alan Johnson, a sociologist, I think has put it very well in terms of this is what resonates with me. So if you don't mind, if I can just read it out. And what Johnson says is, what drives patriarchy as a system is a dynamic relationship between control and fear. Okay? Patriarchy encourages men to seek security, status, and other rewards through control, to fear other men's ability to control and harm them. Okay, so it's really talking about the relationship of men with men. And this is, I think, the key point in my understanding. In this sense, although we usually think of patriarchy in terms of women and men, it is more about what goes on among men. The oppression of women is certainly an important part of patriarchy, but paradoxically, it may not be the point of patriarchy. Okay? So I throw that out, maybe we can come back to it and, you know, play with it if you want. But that really, like I said, it explains it better than I could, I think. But for me, how I look at it is patriarchy is about keeping power in. Okay? To a limited group or tribe, and I don't mean tribe in that sociological sense, I mean in a group of people that you feel comfortable with for whatever reasons. Because also men are excluded. Okay, as Amira was talking about, it's elites. Elites within a given space on a given topic. And we can look at our own university here and other universities to see who is holding power. We can look, you know, all different corporations, music, film, theatre, and we'll see replications of where power is held. It's held by little groups who are kind of reinforcing and reproducing themselves. And even I have this very crude example in the UN. So maybe some of you are aware that when you apply for a job in the UN, you're expected to have a master's degree, okay? And it's, you could think, well, everybody has to have a master's degree, that's okay. But that's already excluding a hell of a lot of people. In many Western countries, and even our, you know, that's changing today, in many Western countries, it may not just be elites that have master's degree. But certainly in developing countries, it's largely going to be elites that have that. So you're already excluding. So the UN is there, I would say, is unintentionally reproducing the fact it's a privileged space. And of course, in the UN, you're meant to speak one of the six languages. So it's already reproducing a certain kind of person. So I'm just using that as an example of a kind of system that is keeping people out. And I also want to point out that I think some of this is quite unintentional. These are unintentional gender biases. There's a lot of research coming about that these days. If you haven't done it, there's a Harvard University unintentional gender bias test. Really, I would encourage you all to take it. It's really good what it reveals, right, to oneself. It's quite scary. But of course, sometimes, let's be clear, it is also intentional, right? People pretend it's not, but it is. So I think we need to figure out, when is it intentional, when is it not intentional? And I think for me, this is now where we're getting to conflict. The patriarchy is based upon and reproduces qualities that are seen and valued as masculine. Okay? So we hear that. That's all the kind of the stereotypes of, if, you know, these masculine qualities of aggression, of being courageous, of dominating, control, superiority, hierarchy, violence, and also hiding your feelings, hiding sensitivities. And on the other side, we see that patriarchy necessarily requires a devaluation or an elimination of qualities that are seen as feminine, so the so-called softer qualities, the nurturing, the passive, the timid, non-hegemonic, etc. So what I'm saying is that these masculine qualities are more valued and seen as superior than feminine qualities. And I also want to point out that I'm not saying that only men exercise masculine qualities and females exercise feminine qualities. I'm not saying that at all. I believe that they're, you know, both practiced by men, and women are also responsible for actually contributing to patriarchy. And patriarchy requires women's acquiescence or active participation in that. But my key point is this, is that if we are saying, or if I'm saying, this is my little theory of change. So if we are saying that patriarchy promotes these masculine qualities, which I'm saying competition, control, fear, superiority, that actually in doing that, you're going to create exclusions. So I'm saying there's a direct link. You're going to create exclusions, and exclusions are going to create inequalities. You could also argue, as some people do, that they say that this promotion of this cooperation, this sense of domination, is going to create inequalities in how people and groups are treated, which leads to exclusion. So it could be inclusion, exclusion comes first, then equalities, or inequalities and then exclusion. But I think, you know, it could work either way. Okay, so what I'm saying is that patriarchal masculinities lead to exclusion and inequalities. That's kind of my little building block. Now, exclusion and inequalities don't per se lead to grievances, right? That formulation of grievances, they may do, but they may not necessarily do that. And even if you have grievances, they may not therefore be mobilized in a violent way. You can resolve your grievances in a peaceful political way. We have grievances, we have inequalities in the UK today, right? Or I think it's about 10%, the top 10% of the population, 10% of the population in terms of income has 40-50% of the total income of the country. Similar figures in terms of wealth. But, you know, so there are grievances there, but they're not necessarily mobilized to respond to those in a violent way. But what my own little understanding is that what happens is that those same patriarchal norms are then instrumentalized, are then manipulated to have militarized responses to exclusion, right? So I'm saying, when I kind of look at it, I'm saying it's the patriarchal masculinities that lead to exclusion and inequalities, and it's patriarchal masculinities that are instrumentalized for and militarized a violent response to deal with responses. And I was in Ukraine in 2014 and meeting with women and men, and we met with a number of men who were actually holed up in a woman's shelter because there was not a man's shelter, because it was considered that men don't need shelters. So a man was holed up in a woman's shelter. He had been conscripted by the Ukrainian government. He had to fight. He did not want to fight. He did not think it's worth his life. But he was bullied and he had to fight. He did not want to. He left and was considered a traitor. So he was holed up there with the women. So that's, I think, it's a very, very, it was the first time I'd experienced that very clear experience of a man being forced to live within those kind of social constructions, which he does not believe in himself, but he has been pushed to go and do that and does not feel comfortable with doing that, and now his life is at risk because he does not wish to fight. Okay, and he didn't even have any support by the state. He had to take private means to go and live in this space. And at the same time, we see that the gender norms meant that the women were the ones that were meant to help the men, were meant to help the soldiers. They needed to, you know, produce children and go, you know, do that nurturing thing and go look after soldiers, which meant that the Ukrainian government didn't actually have to take care of its soldiers. So it gets all very, right, very, very nuanced. Because in theory, you would have thought in Ukraine there would be sufficient funds to look after your soldiers. But given the presence of the oligarchs, there's not so much money. Okay? So for me, there are kind of three conditions for violent conflict. So one, it's the presence of these gendered norms, so these patriarchic gendered norms. Right? So we talked about these patriarchic masculinities, femininities. And then we have this environment in which these patriarchic masculinities are promoted in order, or which leads to the creation of this exclusion and inequalities. which are then which the patriarchal masculinities are then exploited in order to have a violent response to dealing with those inequalities. So the point is, if you want to address conflict, it suggests that you need to transform those patriarchal gender norms, challenge exclusion and inequalities, and challenge militarism as the dominant response to those. And that's what women are doing. Right? And that's exactly what women are doing. So if we take my first point first, which was transforming the patriarchic gender norms and also therefore the relationships, I think the key point is obviously changing norms takes years. Because we're talking about the attitudes, the beliefs, the practices that underpin them. So it really, really does take a long time. We can have some changes in, for example, legislation. That can be done quite quickly. And oftentimes legislation helps to change. It's a bit ahead of how people are thinking. But when we're talking about gender norms, I don't want us just to look at it through what's the kind of legislation, what are the kind of the documents, what are the kind of policies that have been accepted on paper. They may be forerunners. Hopefully they're forerunners, but they're certain. I don't think they're usually behind. I think they're leading. They kind of set the tone, and then hopefully there's change. So I just wanted to make that point about we do need documents, we do need policies and processes, but ultimately we need communities, individuals to change, to be transformed. And in terms of transforming these gender norms, I've seen in a lot of the work that I've been doing with the various INGOs and women's organisations that we're doing, they spend a lot of time working on this. I was in South Sudan last year, and there are a number of different ways in which South Sudanese women are working on this. They are engaged in various educational programs, in terms of educating the girls, but also educating the boys, the men, and also the women. Because sometimes it's obviously women as well that are reinforcing those norms. Just because you're a woman doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be necessarily a feminist or a women's rights activist, because you've been living in a certain way of thinking for a long time. It may be better for your own survival not to stick your head out. So also just want to say that just because you're a woman, it doesn't mean a feminist or a women's rights activist, and obviously the same is true for men. But what we're seeing is, and I think it's similar to what you were doing actually now with your education, in terms of reaching out and trying to change people's different concepts of what is the contribution of women and girls, and also making the point that obviously if women and girls are empowered, if they're able to contribute to the community, all of the society benefits, your health and educational development indicators generally would be going up, you would be having better qualities of life. You, man, if your wife is out earning an income, she will bring that money back into your house, that will directly benefit you. In some societies, that might also increase your own social standing. We saw in Burundi, where I was also there last year, that I was really surprised when I was meeting these women who were living very much in the grassroots area and working with, I'd say, quite small, very local, very commune level, savings and loans associations. And I specifically asked them, how do your husbands feel about you getting involved in these associations? Because I had an assumption that would make the men feel insecure, the fact that these women are having a bit more money in their pockets. And I was really surprised. It's so great when you get your assumptions wrong, right? I was so surprised when these women said, no, actually, these men have said that, number one, the women who belong to these associations, you can see that they're different from the others. They have a little bit more confidence, a little bit more standing in the community. Also, bringing that money back home is actually helpful to the man because it helps to raise him. So the man is actually feeling proud of his woman. So he was not feeling it as a threat. Now, I do not know at what point that may change. Like, I do not know how much the woman has to change because she feels more confident and empowered for the man to feel as a threat. But I thought that's quite interesting, and it's maybe a little bit counterintuitive of the rest of the work that we have been doing. There's also a number of men's organisations that work with women's organisations to transform these gender norms. And there's a lot of work that men engage, which you're not familiar with, I suggest you have a look at that. They're doing some very interesting works with other regional organisations, Abad, for example, in Lebanon, which is really challenging the role of men, the masculinities, and encouraging men to actually see that they have a range of masculinities for them to choose and to try to create that space. So it's about working with individuals, but it's also about also working directly with communities to create that environment in which people can feel that they can have a range of different manifestations of, you know, the people that they are. Turning to the second point, challenging exclusion and inequalities. Women are doing this in a number of different ways, and this is where the peace process, the formal peace process, kind of fits into it, I was thinking. So you're right, there is a lot of attention being given, especially in the past few years, about increasing women's meaningful participation in peace processes. So there's a lot of papers, a lot of articles, a lot of research, a lot of exhortations. There's loads of regional women mediators groups set up. What else is there? Loads of workshops. There's loads of that. And there's more clarity on what meaningful participation means. So it's not just that the women are sat at the table. They have to feel confident, able to talk about the issues. They don't just talk about women's issues, I don't know what they are, but that thing called women's issues. They can talk about whatever they want to talk about. That they can even go and talk down the pub or in the coffee bar where the real negotiations take place. So yeah, that's all recognised. That now, so we actually have some understanding of what meaningful participation means, which is basically being able to affect decision making. So we got all of that. We still don't have women at the table. We have very, very few women at the table. But we have lots of really good efforts. And but we just don't really have the women at the table. So we have the case of Syria, which I think is probably the most well known, where, you know, the so-called Syrian opposition, it didn't really have many women at the table. But remember, in Syria, we need to be just very clear that the opposition and the Syrian government, they never sat together at the table, right? So we're talking about sitting at the table with the UN mediator. So again, we need to be clear about what negotiations at the table we're talking about. So Syrian women have not been at the table. So then the former special envoy, Stefan de Mistura, he sets up a women's advisory board meant to be comprised of independent women representing different perspectives that's meant to advise him. I don't know why it's advising him, but okay, meant to advise him to make sure gender is integrated, and I suppose he can do what he wants with it. So they did advise him, they gave notes on, and you know, what they did is that they had their issues papers, there's a whole, you know, series of baskets or issues that the peace process is looking at, security, justice, transitions, political process, etc. So they gave their views on that, they had gendered it, and he had this information. And then, yeah, I suppose he used that as much as he could, I assume. Why not? Assume positive things. He assumed he used it as much as he could. So that's good. But, you know, that they were advising him. They weren't advising the actual negotiators. The opposition also set up a women's advisory committee, which I worked with. And they also tried to gender papers, but they also had very little influence over the opposition. You have a civil society support room, which is another mechanism set up in Geneva, which has got women and men civil society activists in it. And a number of women say that the space there is dominated by men, and it doesn't enable these women to participate. So these are, you know, it's quite difficult. In Yemen, in 2013, so not in this current conflict, in the previous conflict, there was a national dialogue process that had 30% of women. That was a really good step forward. And then 2014, 2015, we had fighting that's still ongoing in Yemen. Now the women are not part of the process. So that was a positive step forward. I'm using the words of Yemeni women, and now they're kind of not included at the table. When the negotiations took place a couple of months ago in Stockholm, they were standing outside the room. I think we saw that on the TV. However, we do have a few successes. I think Colombia, if people are not familiar with it, please read about it. It will make you feel good. It makes you feel hopeful. It has so many positive ideas and examples. In Colombia, the women's movement came together. And we hit, but remember the conflict in Colombia has been going for 60 years, right? We think about it in the past 5 years, but it's gone for 60 years. So this was the latest reiteration of trying to get together. The women's movement came together, identified their kind of manifesto similar to what your colleagues have done in Pakistan, put pressure on the parties to sit down at the talks. But again, this has been going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. The parties began their negotiations in Havana. Victims came and spoke to the negotiators. So victims and survivors of violations, so it's women and men, they came to speak to them. A gender sub-commission to the peace process was set up. So all the documents, all the thinking had to go through that sub-commission on gender to make sure gender was integrated. There were women negotiators on the FARC side and also so on the rebel side and also on the government side, women negotiators. And now, once the agreement was signed, women's civil society was out there campaigning for the referendum on the peace agreement to be adopted. So these are a number of really positive steps, some of which have happened also in other countries. And the good news now is that there is a truth and reconciliation process ongoing right now. There are 11 members of a commission, 6 are men, 5 are women. And what the actual commission is trying to do is to integrate a feminist approach consciously in its work. So it's just beginning its work. So, you know, we have to be very clear in Colombia, 300 civil society activists have been killed since the signing of the peace agreement that includes women. So I'm certainly not saying that the peace agreement has brought peace to Colombia. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it did highlight some very interesting mechanisms that may be of use, you know, to be tailored in different contexts. I should quickly zap on. We talk about women in the peace process, but we also have women in peace building, and by that I kind of mean what's happening more at the grassroots local level, and that's some of what Amira was talking about. That's in terms of how to deal with conflict at the communal level within the family. Women are engaged in that in terms of doing local mediation. That's also linked to what women do in terms of economic empowerment. We talked about the loans. There's also micro-enterprise, micro-lending that goes on. That's in a number of the countries. In the countries bordering Syria where there's big refugee communities, in Lebanon, Jordan, and also Turkey, Iraq, there's a lot of work being done by those women out there in terms of basically building the resilience, I think, of their communities. And I think that's the key thing that we need to note about what women do at the local level. For me, it has a couple of impacts. Number one, it helps to, I would say, that woman to feel more empowered, more confident in her own being. That therefore affects her family as well. The children are better taken care of. Maybe the children are going to school. Maybe even the girls are going to school. So they are feeling stronger. So I say it's the woman first, the family. She's then more active in the community. She has more confidence to be more active in peace building. So in terms of outside of the family, in the community. And what she's actually helping to do is build up the resilience of those around her, so family and then community, so that, I think for me this is a critical issue, so that therefore that community cannot be instrumentalized or manipulated by outsiders beyond that community. So basically maybe at the capital level, so the capital level grievances can be a little bit insulated because of this resilience and stability that women have brought up. So when people say, well, really, we don't really care about what happens at the local peace building, and we don't want to give you more than £2.50, I think they're really missing a trick, because they don't really get that actually this ink-blot approach, that actually if you can do that in various communities, you're going to get bigger and bigger and expand. But two, you're actually strengthening those communities so that they will be more resilient. Okay, quickly, my last point on the third point is really challenging militarism and the militarization of society. So we talked a little bit about how we can work on transforming patriarchal masculinities. But the other side of this is the whole armaments and weapons business, and what really are women doing on that. And there's a lot that they've been doing. It was women civil society organizations that campaigned for the arms trade treaty in 2013 to have a component which meant that where sellers were wondering if this was going to have an impact on gender-based violence or violence against women, then it was not to be sold. Obviously, they wanted to be a ban on the arms trade, but this was a provision that was inserted because of the advocacy of women's organizations. Women's organizations have led the advocacy on campaigning for states not to sell their weapons to Saudi Arabia, for example, in the case of Yemen. Right, we see that what's happening in the UK, but also in the case of Sweden and Germany, they have suspended their weapons. WILF, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, has led a coalition to actually do analysis on the amount of money that is actually being spent on weapons, what a difference that would make if it was actually being spent on sustainable development. So really what that's trying to do is two things. One is trying to get away from that knee-jerk reaction of their grievances, let's address them violently, so moving away from militarism, but also that has to be accompanied by making sure that weapons are not so easily obtainable. So obviously what would be really great is if the Secretary General, for example, he could, in his prevention work, make disarmament more of a visible component. Thank you for your patience. I'll stop. But there's so much to say.
Thank you, Bella. That was incredibly thoughtful. And again, I think it gives you a sense of the depth of this agenda generally. And what I love, I'm going to use my position here, if I can ask the first question, but we do want to hear from you, how your reactions to these presentations and perhaps even some personal reflections. But I suppose for me, I think I'm really interested in this tension, whether you think there's a tension in the general agenda between regarding women as victims, the focus on victims and violence against women, even structural, but you know, physical violence as well, and this emphasis on the agency, and whether the agenda generally is going in one direction or the other, or how perhaps not we need to keep the balance on, you know, the violence that is inflicted and how women are victims, but also how they can be mobilized to be very positive forces for change in these very traditional areas of security. I'm really going to abuse my position to share, because when I was asked to do this, I thought, oh, I can tell you my favorite anecdote about women in peace processes, and I don't know whether Bella knows this one. I was in Liberia last year, and we were looking at this amazing network called Peace Huts, which was set up by a woman called Ma Annie. And this dates back to the time of the Liberian Civil War, and the peace negotiations were sort of dragged on. And as you say, it's a very exclusive process. Not only was it, of course, all men, but they'd even taken them out of Liberia because they decided they couldn't have the negotiations in the country. So they'd all gone to some sort of fancy hotel in Ghana. Which of course a lot of resentment anyway about, you know, what were, even among the men, what were they doing there and so on. No resolution to these peace negotiations. At a certain moment, Ma Annie got together a whole group of women, took themselves off at their expense to Ghana, to the hotel. They stood outside the building, they locked the men in the building and made it known that A, they wouldn't let them out until they reached a conclusion. And if they were really going to spend a long time about this, all these women were going to take all their clothes off outside the negotiating room and really shame their kind of men. It's kind of on one level, it's a banal and probably plays into all sorts of anti-feminist tropes. But I think the point is that, you know, women do have all sorts of agency and creativity in spaces that were never allowed to have that kind of dimension before. So, let's hear from you. Have you got comments and questions to our panelists? Margarita.
Yeah, so maybe I wasn't allowed to ask questions, but I do have one. So, picking up on Bella's point about the UN inclusion and the programs that they offer, so I completely agree with you. I think that the fact that they do require a master's degree is extremely limiting, and it does sort of enforce the idea that elites will always be elites. When it comes, for example, to internships, the fact that most UN agencies don't pay the internships for 6 months, and they expect someone to be able, someone just off university, so probably already with a massive debt, to basically have to pay for their expenses when living there. So I was sort of wondering, do you think that there is a solution to it? Maybe it's not just necessarily just to Bella, but in general, to like anyone. Do you think that there is a way to actually promote a greater inclusion when it comes to not necessarily just the UN, but sort of like all agencies that do offer internships or like graduate sort of volunteering experiences, but not really fostering this idea of inclusion and equality?
I think it's a good point that Bella was talking about the patriarchal state, and it's the international community as well, and its development practices are often the first culprits. Any other questions? Yeah? We'll take a couple of them.
Hi, thank you so much. Just a technical one. You mentioned a Nigerian author, but how do you write her name?
C-H-I-T-R-A, Chitra. And then the second name is M-A. I'm going to have to write this out. A-R. A-J-A-N. And she's independent now, but she used to work for civilians in conflict prevention, and then she worked for the Nigeria Stability and Reconciliation Program. She worked for International Alert, so she's got quite a lot.
I have a real question now. So it's more a general one, and it's for everyone. I guess your position in the security sector is constantly being questioned because you're a woman, and it's just like generally, is it constantly being questioned, and how do you react to that, and does it get very tiring and frustrating because your opinion is less valued or something like that?
Take one more. Another one.
Hi, thank you so much for this. It was really, really interesting and kind of great to hear some new perspectives. My name's Meg. I'm on the MSc in Women, Peace and Security, so it's my thing. And I'm also a consultant with UN Women. One of the quick things that kind of, I think, came up, or maybe came up around the outset of both of what you were both covering, is the role of the private sector. I think that increasingly we see an impact of the private sector in conflicts, looking at private military contractors, drones, it's a really important question there, but also on more of the peace side of things, the gender side of things. One of UN Women's biggest partners is BHP Billiton, which is, I think, raises some interesting questions about what you think the role of the private sector should be in engaging with women, peace and security. And kind of how, as feminist academics and practitioners, we can engage the private sector, but also kind of mitigate the potential risks and potential for harm there. It'd be kind of great to hear your thoughts.
Should we take those, or do you want to be then, how to promote greater inclusion? Bella, do you want to say something on that? So there's some small good news, is that, some agencies are not having the masters because they've been criticized. They now say all relevant experience, right? So that is a recognition that there are going to be some people out there in the world that are not going to comply with that. I don't think it's particularly gendered in their understanding. It may be in practice, but I don't think that was the original reason. I think it was broader than that. So that's one small change. And this issue of, you know, the 6 month stage not being paid has come up. I don't envisage why it's going to change, because there are still so many people that still keep applying.
So I can't imagine where the money would come from in the first place. And if there are people there, I just can't imagine that changing. So I think it's not a good structure. The only good thing is, I don't know if it's good or bad, but definitely in my time, there were less people that were getting jobs having been interns. So if you don't get to be an intern, I don't think it necessarily affects your chance to get a job, nor am I saying you should want to work in the UN. So I'm not, I have a neutral comment on that, but I'm certainly not, I don't want to come across as I'm advocating it. And to make you feel worse, what inspired you here is that, it's not just a blockage, we're talking about patriarchal institutions, it's not just a blockage at Stage level. If you look at the number of women mediators in the UN right now, you would find it right now, mediators, heads of peace operations, there are a few, but as mediators, mediating peace process, I don't think there's one right now. If there is, I'm having a blank as who it is. There've been a handful. So when the UN then says, oh, hold on, you've got your women, peace and security resolution, you Assad, or you Houthi leader, or you Burundi president have to include women in your negotiators. Who knows if you're seriously? But even I was in Libya when Ban Ki-moon came, and this is a true story. He came in 2012 with his delegation from New York, his team. There were 15 of them, okay? And he's coming before elections. So it's in Libya, right? So he's coming before elections and he's going to come and his talking points say he has to encourage women candidates and freedom for women candidates to run in elections, right? That's in his talking points. They get off the plane and I see there is not one woman in that delegation. So they put me in it because they just needed a woman to be in that meeting. So I was just in that. That's what happens. That's what happens. So who's going to take that seriously? Now, on this question of women in the security sector, so I worked with the Department of Peacekeeping Operations in New York. I had come from the High Commission of Human Rights, which is it's much more a feminist and female space, and I went into this highly masculine environment. And I felt, but I didn't know what it was, but I definitely felt this kind of being juvenilized, actually, kind of experience. I think it was that, and it took me a long time, honestly, to figure it out, because I was so not able to interpret what was going on. I didn't have the language, but I didn't have the analysis to figure out, oh, this is what's actually happening to me. And I had gone from running the human rights component of the UN mission in Sudan in the time of Darfur. So I'd come from quite a responsible job into this job where I was totally pushed on the side. One, because of my grade, because the grade was more relevant in New York than in the field, but also because as a woman, I couldn't be expected to really understand policies and management, peacekeeping, even though I'd run the human rights component of the mission that had like so serious human rights violations going on. So one, it's dissing human rights and it's more valuing soldiers, right? So one, it's doing that, then it's dissing the grade because it's hierarchical, and then it's dissing me. So there's a number of levels of how patriarchy manifests itself. And I had no clue at the time that this was happening. I thought it's me. I thought, oh God, really, I'm no good. But maybe I'm good in the field, which is full of losers, but in this New York, which is the center of the UN, I'm actually no good. You know, big pond, little pond thing.
Amira, do you have experiences of that?
Yes.
How do you get around this discrimination?
Well, yeah, I mean, just to add on the other layer of the intersections. So, obviously, we're both women of colour, or we are both women of colour, if you didn't realise yet. I'm very fair, so I get confused a lot. But I'm still privileged, you know. My dad's from Syria, actually, but I was born and grew up in the UK. So I've managed to like slip into these very northern white male dominated environments as like the diversity hire. So, but the thing is, when you, I still have a bit of lived experience, and you know, half of my family are Syrian refugees displaced by the conflict. So, you know, it's very relevant, and as a feminist analyst, I think about this all the time. So there have been jobs that I've had where I've made it very clear when I was being hired, look, I take a feminist approach, diversity and representation are very important to me, I'll raise it. But often as a woman of colour, when you raise it, you get seen as the aggressive, annoying, naggy, oh God, here we go again. So there's that, but then because I still have my English accent, and you know, I managed to slip by certain things. But then, if you talk about women of colour from the global south, that's a whole different ballgame. So the hardest thing for me was witnessing in many scenarios how women from the global south, and even some men from the global south, were just excluded from opportunities. Under the, you know, different languages of, you know, the lack of experience, even though they had great experience. They didn't go to the elite universities. We don't know if they'll fit in. And so if you don't have that diversity, and you're talking, you know, these elite, particularly elite think tanks around security seem to have a lot of influence. So a lot of governments rely on them for analysis because they don't have the capacity. Not necessarily the UK, because the UK is a bit different, has huge departments, you know, DFID is massive. It invests a lot of capacity in internal analysis, but a lot of countries rely on think tanks. And those think tanks are comprised by elites. And so you don't get a diverse perspective on security issues. So the example of Syria is very relevant because it's been a hot topic of conversation in these, everywhere, but in these circles in particular. But obviously because I have family on the ground, and my family have like ragingly different perspectives within them about who's wrong, who's the main perpetrator, who's the lesser evil. But none of this was represented in those circles. And even if I would raise it, not that I was endorsing any particular side of the conflict, but it would be so out, you know, politically incorrect in that setting. So that was a main concern. So promoting inclusion for me, I think, breaking down these, like, the way even the UN, like, will lean on, like, elite consultants. So once you do one consultancy for the UN, you're in. So you get so many, I've had so many opportunities just because I had one consultancy, whereas there would have been so many more people who would have been much better at that than me. But then I still think the UN is much more diverse than a lot of institutions in my experience. And I kind of, when I started working in different ways with the UN, I had a very negative kind of perspective, but actually met a lot of really great people. It's the structures that have made it difficult for them more than anything else. On the role of the private sector, I started my career in the private sector, and I left it because I was disenfranchised. But all I would say about that is I think things have shifted. Like, it used to be, you know, all the private sector was just always thinking about the bottom line, and of course the bottom line matters. But I've also seen a shift because a lot of people I started with have stayed in the private sector. And as individuals, you know, these issues are important to them. So as they rise up the ranks, they are innovating where they can and making changes, not necessarily in private security contracting, though. But you would know much more about that than us, so please.
Well, interesting dilemma in Liberia, massive explosion in private security. Numbers of private security firms have gone from like 7 to 300 in the last year. And the dilemma is that, yes, we all know about bad practices of big companies hiring private security guards, and actually it's women who are victims of that because they're the ones that get charged or extorted for going to do their jobs or farming and so on. By the guys manning the barrier. The dilemma is that actually the biggest growth in employment of these firms is to women. It's providing employment for women. So how do you manage that? And I think Bella was talking about nuanced responses. I think we haven't got to nuanced responses by the private sector yet. Don't get me onto that. I want very quickly, because we're running out of time, there's some more hands up. So can you do very quick questions, and we'll do some quick answers so we let you get home. But it's just such an interesting discussion. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your panel. It was amazing. I have a question related to peace building, actually. So I would like to ask you, how do you think the role of women during peace building? And asking you this because the context where I am from is Colombia. And now we are facing a post-conflict situation. when you read actually the Women, Peace and Security agenda, you have the perception that is that it focuses mainly on protection and on prevention. So my question is more related to the peace word of the Women, Peace, Security.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
NGOs and the UN, but what about parliaments? Because I think 3 years ago the UN held a workshop with Arab parliamentarians on women, peace and security, and the Iraq delegates came and had this amazing presentation. In the Middle East they have the first national action plan, quotas, anti-domestic violence law. I think they just implemented it. But, you know, I couldn't help just sit there and look at them and be like, well, is that enough? And how do you avoid, you know, parliaments just tick the box and not really make any change?
Okay, can we have the next question?
Hello, I'm an undergraduate IR student, and I wanted to ask you, so you talked about the mass, like, male-dominated space in the security field. Do you think the fact that a lot of, like, security theory, like the theories we have in IR, that they are so male-dominated? And, like, I mean, most of the readings, for example, I do are, like, written by men. So do you think that adds another layer to the inequality?
One more, yeah.
Thank you so much. It's really interesting. I just wanted to circle back quickly to the WPS agenda and how, in my opinion, the words prevention and protection believe and emphasize women as victims and kind of forget about their agency and their role in conflict. And I personally specialize in the role of women in conflict and how they are actors and they're active and not just passive victims. And the terms such as women, peace, and security, this constant association of women and peace sort of perpetuate the idea that women are nurturing our natural peacemakers, and are we not forgetting leadership and empowerment, all these words, and are these, is a change in terminology maybe needed to sort of change this agenda?
Thank you. Quick round of responses. Amira, can I?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
To pick up whatever you want.
So I'll talk about, well, peace building is a very broad term. So I mean, there's been arguments in front of me by, like, people who've done peace building at, you know, learned about peace building at university, and then people who work in the development sector and see their work as peace building, and the person who learned it at university would be like, that's not peace building, development isn't peace building. So I think it's a really broad term. That's all I'm going to say about that. But yeah, just, I think, do we need to define what it is? I don't know. But there's a lot of activity that goes on that, you know, through the kind of norm shifting or attempts to shift norms, potentially has a lot longer, more sustainable impact on peace building than certain peace building initiatives. Parliaments is a really interesting question. And I always do, like, an analysis of parliamentary debates and discussions in all of the work that I do. So in Pakistan, in Jordan right now. Jordan is a good example because there's been a lot of discussions in Parliament around the justice and, you know, not necessarily specifically on women, peace and security, although they do have a national action program, which is, like, a lot of funding is going in from the British government and other donors. But yeah, meaningful participation is something that concerns me, because in Parliament in Jordan that I've seen, it's only been men. Only been women parliamentarians talking about it in committees. Very little engagement from the powerful actors in Parliament, who, a lot of the powerful actors in Parliament come from backgrounds which are tribal, you know, tribal societies. You know, Jordan is a historically tribal society, and, you know, issues, gendered issues are very central to the way that, you know, tribalism works. So, you know, honour, reputation, the honour code is very much around masculinity issues, and decisions are within the realm of men. So I don't know, I haven't got far enough into that research to see anything else. In the case of Pakistan, there are some fantastic women parliamentarians, and I think there's like 33% representation of women in the parliament. But at the same time, the very, very large majority of women in parliament are women who are from feudal background, so that's people who own a lot of land and they have a lot of power. Sometimes it's totally meaningless, kind of, you know, the wives of someone in power. And they're just, you know, they don't even show up to the debates sometimes. So there's a lot of fantastic opportunity for better participation because women's civil society in Pakistan is fantastic and very diverse. So I think there's hope for the future. Security theory, yes, male dominated, but there are some really awesome feminist IR scholars like Cynthia Enloe, for example, and I think we're going to see more and more of those. So I feel hopeful about that. And I have met some kind of male, traditional male IR theorists who are now willing to concede that a feminist perspective is useful. So that's good. And on the women, peace and security, this is something I talked about with UN contacts a lot. And I think I am personally like much more bought into the gender concept. And I think they also are, but it's almost like if we change it now, it'll detract from the great stuff we're trying to do. So that's all I'm going to say about that.
I think linking your first question, Mary, to your question, I think it depends who are we talking about when we're saying are they seen as victims. I don't sense that the women see themselves as victims. I think there's a lot of research now and policy that's saying that don't look at the women as victims, that they are agents with agency. So there may be some programming that's still reinforcing that, but I don't have the sense that that's how the women feel. They may have gone through a process of victim to survivor to agent. I don't know. I think it's very hard to generalize. But I think we need to keep chugging away. I would also prefer it to be gender, peace and security, because I don't think it's about women. I think it's about gender. But again, you know, I think that's not likely to change formally, but if we can actually start looking at these issues ourselves by stealth, and by, I think, one of the professors called it conscious misinterpretation. What I'd suggest to you is ask your professors to pour these articles by these feminist IR scholars. There are so many of them.
Yeah, why aren't they
on
your reading list?
Yeah. I don't see why you wouldn't, right? A couple of new sessions in each class.
Absolutely. I shall leave it there. Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm just running over, but I think you'll agree it's been a great discussion. A couple of final housekeeping points from me. This has been recorded, so if you or any of your friends want to pick it up on the podcast, encourage them to do so. Also, go to the Women, Peace and Security Centre's website if you don't already know it, because there's lots of details there about research and events coming up. And I think we have feedback forms, which you might have been given. Please hand them back as you go out. That helps us in planning future events. And finally, can I ask you to thank our great panelists tonight.